Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the latest episode of the Corta Líneas podcast. I'm your host, Zach Lowy. We've got a great show for you today. In the past few weeks, we've had a wide variety of guests on. David Novo, executive editor of the Record newspaper, Cristiano Oliveira, a Portuguese-American radio host, João Mateus, a coach and analyst in the Portuguese setup. And today we've got a really interesting guest who is a bit more data-focused, but very excited to have him on today. His name is Julio Costa. Julio, or Julio, I guess, because he's Portuguese. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you, Zach. What about you?
Doing well. So it has been a pretty crazy week for Portuguese football. Obviously the biggest storyline happening on Tuesday, with Porto hanging on despite Meritaremi's red card and eliminating Juventus at Juventus Stadium in Turin. So let's dive into the trending topic, which is the Porto victory. I know there are some other headlines with the other Portuguese player on the losing end, but we can talk about that later. What did you make of the match that Juventus played at in Turin?
Well, as you said, like, it was crazy. Like, you know, I know a lot of Porto fans, and of course, like, have a lot of fans that's watched that game, and it was just wow, absolutely wow. And again, like, Porto is known for the kind of character, you know, how resilient they are as a team, and the attitude and determination. And I guess that's pretty much what went to that, you know. While playing 10 men, they'll hang in there, and then they still score that amazing free kick from Sergio Oliveira. And again, from the other side, from Juventus, it was a poor game. I feel that, not taking any credit from Porto, because they had like an amazing achievement with that victory. But Juventus has been lately under Pirlo a bit predictable, in my opinion. There's no much solutions in how to get like forward quickly or get bodies in the penalty box for those like Cuadrado crosses, which only happen really late in the game when you're kind of like trailing behind, or you even have like an extra player. Obviously, there's a lot of things that are wrong, but of course, like, not taking credit at all from Porto. And before that game, like, the build-up, from what I've seen, it was an historic day, because it was, I think it was the 10-year anniversary or something like that, or 11, that Porto beat Man United at Old Trafford, that they drew and they knocked down Man United. So that was kind of like, as for Porto players and also for the fans, kind of like a motivational build-up as well. And as I've seen from Porto this season, especially the Champions League, they're quite patient, and then they explore the opponent's weaknesses. Some might not say it's not necessarily a beautiful game that they play, but I would say it's quite effective. And again, it proved to Porto that they knew what they were doing. They studied Juventus' weaknesses. They knew which areas were the weakest for them to attack and to defend, and of course they did really well in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, I would like to separate Juventus's poor showing on the night with the it as a collective, with just pointing out that I thought that Juan Cuadrado and Federico Chiesa did very well for themselves, despite an overall pathetic showing from Juve. Yes, Chiesa missed that one chance where he was being closed down by Pepe, but overall, he and Cuadrado were really the only ones who stepped up for Juventus. What did you make of Pepe's showing? Because for me, that was just one of the best center back showings I've ever seen. Yes, he was playing in, you know, a deep block, but it wasn't like he was just, you know, well, it wasn't like he was, you know, in a Sean Dyche Burnley's 4-4-2, you know, just heading away crosses. Now, he was actually tracking back, sprinting forward and sprinting backwards. This was as much of a mental display as it was, you know, an athletic display. At 38 years of age, he showcased why, on his day, he is still one of the best central defenders in Europe.
Well, I agree with you, with Chiesa and also with Cuadrado. They were definitely the best players. And Chiesa is like, you can see that he will be a prominent, you know, like figure in Italian football for sure. And regards to Pep, as you said, it's amazing as well. You know, 38 years old and Rio Ferdinand actually on BT Sports, he said that if he was a manager, he would show, you know, his youngsters defenders, especially center backs, how to actually defend. That's how he saw that performance, and for me, it was just amazing. And again, as you said, it was just not sitting down and just clear everything. It was the athleticism, the tracking back, as you mentioned, how he keeps that like physical form at 38 years old is just amazing. And again, the mental preparation and pressure as well that he goes at Turin Stadium and just have that amazing game, you know. It's just incredible. And of course, like for a lot of Portuguese people, you know, we see this as like, okay, he can still be part of this hero squad for sure. Now, what we're thinking, at least in my mind, is how do we replace it? Because that, for me personally, I'm not too worried about Ronaldo's case. Like, okay, we need Ronaldo to be replaced in the national team in a few years. My biggest concern right now is the center back pairing. And of course, like if Pep leaves the national team after the Euro Cup, then that will be a problem. Of course, there are some youngsters that are coming now and they're playing well. But of course, the level that you have and having him with Ruben Dias as center backs this Euro Cup is going to be massive for that back four, if you play in the back four, which I assume that's what it's going to be. And it's just amazing. I did enjoy his defending game was amazing.
I'm glad that you brought that up because, you know, I took a lot of heat on Tuesday when I said that Pepe will be a lot harder for Portugal to replace than Ronaldo. And, you know, I realize that this is Twitter. And, you know, a lot of people support players instead of clubs. And a lot of people, when you criticize Ronaldo or Messi, they will get super offended and just spout nonsense. But I did not mean to discredit Ronaldo's accomplishments for the Portuguese national team. I mean, alongside Eusebio, he is the greatest Portuguese player of all time. However, when you look at Portugal's attacking options, André Silva, Rafael Leão, João Félix, Pedro Neto, Francisco Trincão, Diogo Jota, and so on, Bernardo Silva even though he's probably the oldest at, what is it, 26 years old, not to mention Bruno Fernandes in midfield, I mean, I think that they will be fairly well suited to replacing Ronaldo. On the other hand, Portugal's center back options, at least in comparison, aren't great. You know, of course, Ruben Dias has been phenomenal for Manchester City this season since joining from Benfica. Outside of Dias, though, you know, there's an argument to be made. I think that José Fonte, at even 37 years of age, is still Portugal's third best center back. Outside of him, you have guys like, I think it'll be between Domingos Duarte and Ruben Semedo for that fourth center back slot for this summer's Euros. David Carmo at Braga, once he returns from injury, I think will be in that conversation as well. Feo was part of that collection of young talent that came through following Bruno Lage's appointment at Benfica alongside João Félix and Florentino Luis, but he hasn't really kicked on. You know, we thought there would be a solid partnership at club and country between Dias and Feo, but those two's career paths have sort of gone in opposite direction. Feo loaned out at Valencia. And I mean Diogo Leite and Diogo Queiroz, another pairing that were expected to do well, that had done well at the youth level for Portugal as well as at the youth level for Porto. Leite, on the other hand, has mostly ridden the bench under Sergio Conceição. Diogo Queiroz, on the other hand, joining Famalicão. So in summary, there aren't many great options. You know, Eduardo Quaresma as well, another player who was expected to take the leap this season, but has really struggled for game time under Ruben Amorim. Gonçalo Inácio has done well in the right side of the back three, but still concerns over how he will adapt to playing at a higher level, playing in a back four as well. Personally, if I was Fernando Santos, I would be testing England's resolve and calling up Ezri Konsa. I know that he is eligible for England, Portugal, and I believe Angola as well. So no guarantee he would accept a call-up, but I think it's just worth a shot because, you know, after Dias, I think that he is probably the best young center back that Portugal could have but to play in the post Pepe and Font era. But in summary, I just think that it'll be a lot tougher for Portugal to replace Pepe than replace Cristiano Ronaldo. And then that's not to say that Ronaldo hasn't been a force to be reckoned with over the past, what, two decades at this point. It's just that the options who are at, you know, a similar level, they're just so much more, there are a lot more options who are at a similar level of Ronaldo than with Pepe. And, you know, I wanted to get your take on what have you made of Ronaldo this season under Andrea Pirlo. There have been a lot of rumors over the past few days linking him to a return at Real Madrid. But would he be in your Portugal XI? Obviously, he will be starting this summer because, you know, Fernando Santos is going to play his captain. But I wanted to get your take. If you were the coach, would he be in your lineup?
Well, I mean, as you said, and like, you know, Twitter can be an interesting place at times, and agree with you. Like, just because you're saying that, you know, it's harder to replace one player if you look at the depth that a squad has, and agree with you like 100%. And hopefully, Ezra would say if he could join Portugal, I would say it would be the best addition on that. With regards to Ronaldo, this season, it's a strange one because, you know, I was talking with, you know, like with some people on Twitter, and it's always interesting. As you said, you have like some Ronaldo haters, some Messi haters, and then, you know, you say something about one and you get like fired all over. And like, you know, it's just like really, really interesting where you cannot separate like kind of a different perspective and view on players. Like, I feel that last season with Sarri, you know, it was not the best Ronaldo that I've seen, of course, but it was still a bit better in terms of what the team could have done for him and what he could do with the team, because Ronaldo is the kind of player that it will probably, and I would say maybe it's slightly less for Messi, because Messi is more of a creator kind of player, but Ronaldo will give you as much as you kind of give it to him. And that's why the partnership with Real Madrid was the perfect partnership. You know, you had creative players and you had players that linked so well with Ronaldo as well on the front three that, you know, every season it would have been amazing. And that's the problem at Juve. Of course, we have a lot of inconsistency from a lot of players, and that makes it difficult to get to that main target player, because that's the role that Ronaldo has now. It's the Ronaldo that was at Man United and beginning of Real Madrid was kind of more creative, kind of more dribbling. He still dribbles right now. You can see some time to time, but it was more of kind of, we have this term that to disrupt kind of like, you know, the defenses. That's what he used to really do. And now he's more of the target player. And it's kind of hard when either he has to be the one kind of dropping a certain lines to get that ball. I've seen so many times in this Juve team. At Real Madrid, literally you would see him sometimes, of course, like when out of possession, he would help and defend. But when the team was in the build-up, you would see Ronaldo midfield up. Now you see him kind of dropping even further because there's no passing lines or there's no movement, just because of the way that Pirlo patiently wants that ball. And it's quite interesting as well, because I don't know if you guys had the chance to read, but I did read Pirlo's thesis for his UEFA Pro qualification. And it talks about how this concept of like attacking and enthusiastic and fun football from all these different managers. But then when you look really how Juventus is playing, it's just very, very different. Like, there's some good individual talent as well. You have Kulusevski as well and Chiesa, but mostly it will get that possession kind of like build up a little bit slow, and then we'll get into the air into one of the wide channels to see if they can get deliver that cross to the area and just see if there's bodies there. Again, like Cuadrado is one of the I think. So far with these two matches, he has the most assists in the Champions League. So it kind of like tells you what is the most attacking outlet in terms of like of what they want to get that ball. And again, if you have like certain teams that will be defending those areas, even for players like Ronaldo or like for Morata to get those crosses, it can be difficult, as you've seen against Porto. And going back to the Ronaldo part of it, I mean, I would put him always on my team. I feel that with Ronaldo and Messi, it doesn't matter if they're, and this might sound really, really kind of bad in the sense of planning, but these two type of players, they just attract so much opposition that you really want them to have in the pitch so they can open up spaces for others. And just having Ronaldo, when you have to face Ronaldo or Messi and you have to mark 2-3 players, that's such an advantage for the attacking team, the one that you have those kind of players. And of course, you know, like moments of brilliance also can happen when you least expect with this kind of player. That's why I would always have Ronaldo on my starting 11. And the attitude, you know, like he really pushes all his teammates. I know that some people kind of make fun of it now on Twitter, but it's very important to have someone who can just drive and kind of like give that energy and kind of lead the team. And I would say that makes a big difference in terms of like of the mentality of the players around it. If you look at it at Man United, for example, not giving the kind of like not comparable, but still in the same sense, Bruno Fernandes has kind of like, you know, when he went to Man United, he gave this attitude, you know, he's kind of like, okay, we're Man United. This is how we have to play. We have to win this way. We have to, come on, guys, let's go. Kind of giving that the kind of a leader role in that squad. And that's something that, like, for example, Ronaldo gives to the national team that we didn't used to have before that. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, we do have great players like Figo. He's done that as well, but not to the extent that Ronaldo gives, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to disagree with that. Ronaldo still provides something that not many, really no other Portuguese player can provide, in just striking fear into the minds of defenders. So no matter what, he will have a massive role to play this summer at the Euros. I want to switch gears now and get into another topic of our podcast, which is Portuguese managers coaching abroad. So we discussed this on the podcast a few weeks prior with Vasco Samuco, but I want to get into a little more of the tactical setup of a few of these coaches. There are plenty of managers who are coaching abroad at this point. Obviously, Nuno Espirito Santo, Pedro Martins at Olympiacos, Abel Ferreira, you know, only just took charge of Palmeiras and has already gotten two trophies in his cabinet. So it's just pretty incredible, honestly. And yeah, I think that we are going to be seeing a lot more Portuguese managers abroad. But I wanted to get your take on, if you had to pick two managers from Portugal currently coaching abroad who have impressed you the most, who would you say have impressed you the most over the past year or so?
Well, I would definitely start with Abel Ferreira, of course. You know, he has done incredible well in like 4 or 5 months. Two trophies in the, you know, with Palmeiras, it's amazing. And Paulo Fonseca is also a very interesting one. I'll tell you why that. I'll start with Abel. So we in Portugal, coach education and kind of like what managers actually go through in their early years, there's a common denominator. I don't know if this was talked before, but our coaching principles and the way that coaches are prepared are because of one single brilliant mind who created this concept of tactical periodization. And his name is Vitor Frade. And the way that he sees football is, okay, you train exactly the same way that you're going to play. So if you play this way, then you have to do it for a prolonged duration. So during your trainings, you still have your set times, your exercises, the way you want to train for matches and match preparation, but it's all about your team, what you can do and how do you prepare for competition. And of course, even on that sense, he identified there are several moments of the game, and all these several moments of the game have to be coached and prepared for your matches. We can look at, for example, very different philosophy. You have Guardiola, who has this kind of like Cruyff influence and the way that he plays and the way that he wants football to be and his philosophy. And of course, you have other managers that have different philosophies. But what kind of differs from the Portuguese one is that we do really coach kind of like this way. And I heard someone saying, oh, but why is this team playing like this? Well, let's say that you have to prepare for a moment that your team is not going to have possession. And then from there, you need to transition into attacking and do it quickly. So you have these Portuguese managers that follow this kind of like school of thought that Vitor Frade created. And most of these managers that you actually just kind of wanted to have my take on it, they all somehow are connected because of Vitor Frade. Either because of previous managers like Mourinho or Queiroz, for example, that they all come from this different school, and then from learning from all the managers as well, that, you know, for example, you have Abel, who played for with Paulo Bento, who played for Fernando Santos, and you know, all these managers, in the end, they gain all this expertise and knowledge, but it's all based on of course, on Vitor Frade's model of tactical periodization. And then at the end of it, of course, they kind of mix it up with their own like style of play, but it's usually following that model. And that makes Portuguese coaches quite adaptable, because the way that our own philosophies as coaches, at least that's what in Portugal is being tough, is that you have to be adaptable. Of course, there's going to be moments that you might be in one situation, so you need to train in that situation. Of course, you might expect what your opposition might do, but you still need to kind of do that. And for me, Abel has been amazing. He started at Sporting under 16s, if not mistaken, and then he kind of progressed to the B squad. And then he went to Braga as well. I think it was after first or second season at the B squad, it was promoted to the first team. The team was playing really good football. And then from there, he, of course, unfortunately, he was sacked and then went to PAOK. And after that, to Palmeiras, and he has done an amazing job. I watched the River second leg match, and of course, like, you can see that River dominated, but the way that it was expected to be a game to be dominated. So of course, the way that he set up, kind of like that tactical setup of allowing the opposition to play a different way, not creating as much threat, of course, then in the end, of course, the quality of the players will have an effect on that. But it did break away several times for counter. Maybe the players could have scored maybe two goals. Maybe the talking point wouldn't be, oh, River almost went to the final because of VAR. No, like, that's how we set up his teams. At Braga, when he was at Braga, the same way, he set up really well the teams, and they were playing different moments, not just defending. They knew when to defend. They knew when to keep possession. They knew when to also attack. And that's what I really like about as well. Abel, he has like a really interesting take in his players and the way that kind of like his work ethic. One thing I really like about Abel as well is very humble. You see a lot of managers, especially in Portugal, you see some of them that might be a little bit more, you'll say, arrogant, which it's very debatable depending on what you like on the manager or a manager or not, but he is a hard worker, and you can see that he relates really well with people. And I had the pleasure to hear as well, you know, his motivational speech before the River off time on the first leg, and it was just amazing, and I really like it. With Paulo Fonseca as well, I always thought he was interesting when he had his first appointment at Passos Ferreira. It was one of the best football being played at the time, I remember. It was really good. He done really well. They qualified for the Europa League that year. And then when he jumped to Porto, a lot of people questioned that, if he was ready to take the job. Now, Porto, unfortunately, was having some financial troubles. They had spent a lot of money previously with managers that didn't really work out, and he got caught up on not having the players really that he wanted. And again, he was still, I would say, he was not ready for that big jump as well. Then he went back to Passos, an amazing season again. Went to Braga. I would say between him, Abel, and Jorge Jesus, and Domingos, I would say these four managers, and now Carvalhal, they're quite comparably in terms of how they put the Braga squad. How is it right now? They all continued each other's work, and he had like he played. That was a really good Braga squads. And again, Shakhtar the same. They've done really well. And at Roma, he even change his game in terms of like the way that it's still the same model and concepts and things like that, but now he has like a very good an analysis department with him. And funny thing, like during, you know, in Portugal, there's this kind of like podcast TV show that was during the first quarantine. And you had the analysts of Paulo Fonseca speaking, and it's really interesting because he definitely sets up the same principles, but he kind of like, he wants to trap their opponents as well. He kind of plays that way. And you see so many times that he forces this team because the way that he sets up, and it's quite interesting. I really like the way that he prepares his teams as well. And again, really good manager as well, in my opinion.
Yeah, I just want to point out, over the past 13 years, Braga have had a treasure trove of managers. Jorge Jesus, Leonardo Jardim, Gesualdo Ferreira, Sergio Conceição, Paulo Fonseca, Abel Ferreira, Ruben Amorim, and now Carlos Carvalhal, who's doing a phenomenal job at Braga. I want to get into our talent of the week section that we do at the end of each episode. We've discussed a lot of promising young talents, both in Portugal as well as Portuguese players playing abroad. Who is your talent of the week for today's episode?
My talent of the week is what's his name? Eustáquio. Stefan Eustáquio, so he's Portuguese-Canadian, and he is an amazing talent, a midfielder. I don't think the national team are, they're still debating if they're going to naturalize him or not, if he's going to be eligible to play for Portugal.
Actually, he has declared for Canada.
He's declared. Yeah, he's such an amazing player, and I know that Sporting has been following him, and the same for Braga as well. And considering that, for example, João Mário is on loan from Inter, and if Sporting doesn't have the money or cannot afford to pay the amount that Inter is requesting, I would say it would probably be the best replacement for João Mário, because he's just outstanding. And I'm still thinking to this day, because I quite know him for quite some time, when he first started to play at Chaves, I would say probably two seasons ago or so, three. And I always wondered why none of the other clubs actually went to get him. Because he is such a good player. And I would say one of the reasons why Passos Ferreira is like fifth place.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. If you are curious for more about Eustáquio, definitely check out the piece on the website. It was a fantastic article by Jaime Silva. And yeah, that was confusing how he rejected teams such as Sporting and I believe Newcastle as well to join Cruz Azul, but he's back at Passos de Ferreira and playing a massive role in their push for Europa League football. So I definitely think he would be a great signing for a club like Sporting, although I do think that Porto is probably a more likely option, you know, as a long-term replacement for Danilo Pereira. Whatever happens, I think he's definitely going to be off to a big club this summer. So without further ado, my talent of the week is Abel Ruiz. Abel, he began his career at Barcelona's famed La Masia Academy. I believe he won several titles at the youth level for both Barcelona and Spain. And he did get a few minutes of game time at Barcelona. Obviously struggled to make that jump given the competition with players such as Luis Suarez there. But he joined Braga as part of the deal for Francisco Trincao in January. And Trincao, it's interesting. He remained on loan for the end of the season, and he helped Abel Ruiz settle into life at in Braga, which I thought was a nice detail. So Abel, you know, he was kind of in the shadow of Paulinho a bit. But 1 year after the Trincao deal, Braga completed another swap deal with Sporting paying, I believe it was 16 million euros for Paulinho, who, you know, has been one of the best strikers in the league for Braga over the past year or so. So Paulinho going to Sporting, where he hasn't played much due to injuries, and Andras Porar going the other way on loan, as well as Christian Borja joining on a permanent deal. And with Porar, I guess, not being as good as Paulinho and struggling a bit with injuries as well, Paulinho, Abel Ruiz has really stepped up as the talisman of attack, you know, alongside players such as Lucas Piasson and Ricardo Horta. He's been on an incredible run of form over the past few weeks. Got an assist against Tondela, got a goal against Nacional, was absolutely crucial in Braga, beating Porto at the Estadio do Dragão with a brace and progressing to the Taça de Portugal final despite playing with 10 men. And he recently picked up a goal and assist in a crucial game against Vitória de Guimarães. So, and it seems that he will be called up for the Spain U21 side this month. So he's been absolutely fantastic for the Minotos recently. And I do think that he could be the next Braga player to get a big move. But right now, most important thing is just staying focused at the job at hand, getting Champions League football back to Braga. But he's really gone up another level under Carlos Carvalhal. And I'm really excited to see what happens next. But without further ado, thank you so much, Julio, for coming on. And it was a real pleasure to have you on. And I really hope you can be on again soon on the podcast.
So it's my pleasure as well. And thank you for the invitation. I really enjoy it and looking forward for another invitation as well.
All right. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. And we will have another podcast for you guys up on Monday. So stay tuned for that. I hope you have all enjoyed listening. And remember to subscribe and follow the Corta Líneas podcast to stay updated for future episodes.